This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, in this portion of the program, we talk about the development of children's brains. Our guest, pediatric neurologist Ann Barnett. Dr. Barnett is co-author of the new book, The Youngest Minds, Parenting and Genes in the Development of Intellect and Emotion. The Youngest Minds draws on the latest research in neurology and psychology, and it incorporates new findings from a study by the National Institutes of Health on child care. Your questions about child development, behavior, and child care are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, the phone number is 333-9455. Outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Ann Barnett is a medical doctor. She is also professor of neurology at George Washington University School of Medicine and a member of the Department of Neurology at Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. Dr. Barnett's co-author on The Youngest Minds is her husband, Richard Barnett. He is a distinguished fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. Married for more than 40 years, they are parents and grandparents. Toll-free, our number, 1-800-222-WILL in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Dr. Ann Barnett, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon to you. Thank you.
Why did you write this book, you and your husband?
We each started at a little bit different place. I, as a physician, care for many children with developmental disorders, and I'm often met by parents searching questions. I felt that we were now ready, because of the science, if not to answer those questions, at least to give a report, an update on where we are in the knowledge of how the youngest minds function.
Mm.
Richard Barnett, my collaborator now in 45 years of marriage, mm. and we're now, our fourth grandchild was born actually on the publication date of this book,
Oh,
14 days old. He has had a long interest in global economics and the changes that have been wrought in social structures by the tremendous changes in the world economy, and then came to be interested in how these are affecting family structure, family life, and above all, children. So we decided to give it a go together.
Hmm. Were there surprises for the two of you as you did the research and the work for this book?
Oh, yes. These areas are full of surprises. They're also full of confirmations of ancient wisdom. Science is, after all, a cumulative process. There are clues, there are theories, and they're actively being tested each day. I think one of the biggest sources of interest and amazement to us give 2 points. One is the extreme rapidity of brain development during the early years of life. The brain grows at a rate that never again will be equaled. And most of this brain growth has to do with the increasing connectivity between nerve cells, between the neurons. They hook up one with the other and with the organs of the body and muscles and so on, and they are the basis of what we think, what we do, indeed, perhaps, who we are. Mm-hmm. And most of this brain growth is in the frontal part of the brain behind the forehead, where so-called higher functions, cortical functions, are controlled. So that's one big surprise, option to explore, to learn, to master our environment. But prolonged stress, chronic failure, abandonment can impair the ability to learn and the laying down of memory. That's been shown very definitely in animal research, and there's at least some beginning knowledge that this is also true for human children as well.
Mm. You write in The Youngest Minds that psychologist William James was right in thinking that the brain is not so much a thing as a process. When and how does brain or that process begin?
Well, the process begins with the laying down, the construction of the nerve cells of the brain, a prenatal phenomenon in the second trimester or so, by the end of the second trimester. But these cells are equipotential. They're not dedicated to vision or to hearing or to breathing or to control of a function. They are the cells out of which the dedicated cells are formed. But that dedication to a certain specific function occurs only as the cells begin to migrate to the place in the brain where they will end up as part of a functional unit, whether it's the cells in the language parts of our brain or the cells in the limbic or emotional part of our brain. The dedication and refinement for a specific function comes about gradually. Most of the migration is finished by the time of birth. But the human brain is relatively, at least in its higher functions, is quite unfinished at birth compared to that of other animals. Our breathing centers work, and our heart beat is controlled by central nervous system cells. Those functions are immature in a newborn, but they're more mature than those that have to do with thought, imagination, action, muscular control, and self-control. That process of maturing, the wiring up of the brain, mm-hmm. of the cortex of the brain, happens mostly after birth and mostly in those first few years of life, which is why it's so important.
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah.
In those first couple of years. Stimulation of the brain is critical. How does stimulation lead to brain development, experience? How does experience, that stimulating experiences, lead to brain development?
Again, most of our more exact information comes from animal research, and then also from the dreadful experiences of some children who are deprived of experience and therefore suffer damage to their developing brain on account of either physical or sensory or emotional deprivations. But to go to the animal research for a moment, it's pretty clear that good, varied experiences in an animal encourage the formation of richer and denser brain connections. When mice or chimpanzees are raised in enriched environments with lots of playthings, companions, varied food, they end up having more connections among their brain cells, and then behaviorally, on behavioral tests, they also do better. Well, we will be learning a little more about how this happens in a child as the with the development of the new technologies for such as brain imaging, the functional MRI tests, and electrophysiological tests, so that we are able more and more to see and understand the brain while it's solving a problem or learning something, and seeing, for example, practice effects in the brain, how certain for violinists who begin their careers as young children, and you know they have to use the little fingers of their left hand, which most of us right-handed people don't use very much. But the areas of right, the motor areas of right-handed violinists for left finger control are bigger than they are in the rest of us who don't play the violin or use those fingers. And so we same thing with language areas. Those people who are start their careers as bilingual people early on have slightly different brain organization for language functions than those of us who start in high school or college. So the brain gets organized by experiences.
Yeah. Assuming the general wellness of a child, the most critical factor in the development of an infant's brain is human interaction, and key to that is language. There appears to be a human need for language, for expression. Are there genetic instructions for language? Are there language genes?
It's a good question. The answer really is not known or at least confirmed, although there have been recently some studies of families that have an inherited language disorder, and a recent 1998 paper suggests that these individuals have a chromosomal area that's different from their the other people in the family who don't show this language abnormality. But this these findings are still pretty shaky. I think most of us think there are going to be it's going to turn out that there are language genes in the sense that there is an innate, inborn human capacity for language that must be supported by the way our brains are basically structured, and that those basic structures are heavily influenced by the genetic material we carry. I mean, the evidence for this is that all humans learn language. They don't have to be, unless they're, as you started this question, unless they're tremendous environmental abnormalities or they have a severe hearing loss or something of the sort. Even people with a hearing loss, if they have normal social lives, learn language but use signs instead of vocal language. So this urge to communicate and to communicate via symbols that are connected in certain arbitrary ways that we call syntax or grammar, these structures of language seem to be the same worldwide in all natural languages. There seems to be underlying structures for both grammar and symbol usage, and I think this is a great contribution of Noam Chomsky, who was certainly the first linguist to state this so clearly. The short answer is they probably are language genes. They haven't been identified. They're probably not language genes at the level of behavior, words, but they probably have to do with our ability to use short-term memory in certain ways, for our ability to put together sense from very fragmentary information, from our ability to process rapidly changing data, such as in appear in words, and whether they're signed or spoken. And so there's probably a whole bunch of components that go up to make up the language facility that humans have.
And language has to be fostered. And that happens in what you call a language-rich environment. What is a language-rich environment?
Yes. What we're talking... Now, this doesn't negate what I just said, that people learn to talk, to communicate using verbal symbols and strung together by rules in just many, many different kinds of environment. It's very hard. I mean, it's a very sturdy ability. But language proficiency, language style and use really seems to depend a lot on the experiences a language learning child gets, how much support that child gets for language development, the vocabulary that's used by the people around him, the whether or not a parent or other important caregiver is interactive in communication with the child. Language is symbolic communication, but for a child, it's communication. We talk in The Youngest Minds and in our book about the language of the heart, and certainly this emotional communication between a child and his or her most intimate caregivers, it's out of this emotional communication, the language of the heart, that the more symbolic language emerges. Children have to be motivated to speak, and an environment that encourages verbal usage, books that's linguistically rich, encourages learning.
Yeah, and children need to be included in the conversation. They need to be listened to. They need to be talked with.
Exactly, exactly.
What can families and caregivers do to enrich the language experience for children? How can we look around our environment and sort of give ourselves a grade and say, well, there's room for improvement here? How can we take a look at, you know, where we are and what kinds of things can we do to improve the situation?
Well, I think that that being conscious of one's, as a parent, one's ability to communicate even with a very small child is important, and to take enjoyment in it. It certainly creates enjoyment in a child, the little backs and forths of interactive conversation, even if they're just goos and gahs and, mm-hmm. and not words. We're certainly not talking about drill and vocabulary lists. Children learn best in context, in affectionate context. If mothers and fathers can remember when they're dressing the child to name the articles of clothing, or to these little games, where's your nose, and so on. The parents really just do this sort of thing. But if we have a strong, silent kind of parent, I think maybe being a little bit more conscious of the importance to the child may help. I think children need silence, too. They don't need a constant chatter. They need a chance to pick up on the conversation or turn away from it. But to be sensitive to what the child is feeling and his readiness to use the moment, I think is very good, whether it's in the car or in the supermarket or the cleaners or at home. Probably also it'd be a good idea to turn the TV off more, because this sort of chatter does not really foster language development, unless it's a program that the parent interprets to the child, so that becomes an object of interest in conversation. But the television is just noisy background in many, many homes. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think has been shown to be very good for children's language development is the one-on-one interactive reading, where the parent holds the child on his lap or close to him or her, and either points to the pictures. It doesn't have to be the words in the book for little children. Later on, they'll hold you to the exact words in the book, but the little ones don't. But they enjoy the interaction, and then they learn that the symbols in the book or the dog is the same as their pet or the neighbor's dog next door, so that they get an idea of connecting books and print with real life interests. That begins early.
Yeah. Are there differences in how women and men communicate with babies, their styles of interaction?
Well, broadly speaking, there are just a lot of cultural differences between men and women in our society, and that carries over to child rearing, of course. There may be some, more biological or physiologically seated differences between the way men and women interact with their children. This, of course, as all these gender issues do, arouses big controversy. There certainly, in most cultures, are different styles of interaction.
Mm.
And also, boys and girls are treated differently.
Yeah. In the youngest minds, you write that there is a large number of folks who believe children become what they are biologically programmed to be. This is a really interesting area, I think. And this leads me to ask this question. Does social interaction influence temperament?
This, as you know, is also a contentious subject. I think that many of the, quote, innatist psychologists, those who really bring that we really believe that we, each individual brings to the world the stubborn, inherited, temperamental traits, and there's a lot of evidence that this is true, even that group also now believes and is coming to demonstrate that environmental factors play also a very great role in modifying temperamental tendencies, such as, for example, shyness or irritability or outgoingness or impulsivity. So I think that the interaction of genetic tendencies with both the immediate experience and the life story, the life trajectory and the sum, the cumulative experiences of a person, I think are best described the situation of nature versus nurture as rather than a statement of that it's either nature or nurture that's dominant and predominant. The interaction seems to be what's important.
Mm-hmm. You don't really care for that nature-nurture dichotomy.
Oh, I think the new genetics and the revolution in genetics and technologies really tell us that the that way of stating the question is no longer useful. I think even identical twins who, and there's a lot of very, very interesting twin research, as you know, in university, your university, that shows both that identical twins tend to choose their factors from their environment similarly, and they then tend to be more like each other than like their other sibs or like a fraternal twin, even if they're adopted out and raised apart. But still, it's very clear that even identical twins are can be very, very different from each other, even when they've been raised together and gone to the same schools. I mean, you take a disease like schizophrenia, which is at least partially inherited. If one identical twin has schizophrenia, the other twin is more likely to have schizophrenia too, but not. But he's actually just as likely not to have schizophrenia, showing that even this dread disease is not totally a matter of inheritance or susceptibility. The susceptibility to the to a disease has to be acted on in a certain way, and we don't always know the way. We know that identical twins, one with and one without schizophrenia, both have inherited the tendency towards schizophrenia because their children, schizophrenic and non-schizophrenic twins, are equally likely to have the disease. So we know that there's the heritability is there, but the behavioral manifestations are not. So there's still just a tremendous amount that needs to be, that is being learned about how this plays out, genetic tendencies and life history.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon is pediatric neurologist Ann Barnett.